Hi, this is Mimi, and welcome to my podcast, The Lovely Becoming. Today's guest is Liz Earnshaw, who's an LMFT, a licensed marriage and family therapist based in Philadelphia. You probably follow her at Liz Listens on Instagram, but if you don't, you should definitely check it out. Hi, Liz, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. I'm so excited to be here with you today.
Me too. Thank you so much for your time, and I'm so glad we could connect in person-ish.
Me too. I'm really excited to be able to see you and chat with you.
Yes. So tell us about yourself. What do you do? What do you love?
I love that question. So I am a couples therapist based out of Philadelphia, and I love working with people in relationships, not just couples. I love working with sibling pairs and parent-child and friendships and all sorts of stuff. And I also own and run a couple businesses. So that's something I love as well. I love creating relationships in the workplace. So I have a private practice. I run, I have co-founded a company called Actually alongside two other people where we're trying to bring premarital counseling into the world in a more accessible way. And I also run some courses online. And I recently released a book called I Want This to Work, which I'm really excited about, that is all about how to build a healthy relationship with your partner.
That's so exciting. I can't wait to read it. I just saw the cover and it looks beautiful.
Thank you so much. They did such a good job. It's wild how much has to go into making a cover. And they would send me an idea and I'd be like, that doesn't really feel like me. And then they sent me that one and I was like, that's perfect. I love it.
I'm so glad. I can't wait to read it. That's wonderful.
Yeah, I'm excited for it to be out.
And why did you choose to become a marriage and family therapist specifically?
So it's kind of a unromantic story. I was driving down the highway and I was really lost in my life. I had just graduated from school. I had a degree in organizational development, which is essentially consulting. And I was like, what business is going to want me to consult with them? I don't know. I haven't even worked in a business before. Like, what did I get this degree for? And there was this billboard for a marriage and family therapy program. And I thought, oh my gosh, I didn't even know that was a thing. But I think I would like that. And so I went home and I Googled the program and I immediately sent in an application. And I signed up for like my GREs and all of that. And luckily I got in because I didn't apply to any other program. I just applied to that one. It was very impulsive, but I'm so glad I did because for whatever reason, that billboard really struck me. I was like, yes, I want to work within a system of people, which is why I did the organizational development thing. But I also really love intimate relationships. And so to have the opportunity to work with couples or families, I just felt really, really drawn to that.
I love that. That's so wonderful. And I think it's interesting once you get into the work as well, figuring out what you like to do and which specialties you like and things like that. But I really like the marriage and family route and thinking about that system because it does really impact those early relationships do really impact the way we show up in relationships today. What kind of boundaries are there?
What kind of boundaries are there in relationships or when you are a therapist?
Oh, that's a good one. Both.
Both. Awesome. Well, I mean, I think that they replicate each other, right? Like the boundaries that therapists have to have, especially as they're becoming a therapist, are very similar to the boundaries we have to have with other people. So I'll talk a little bit just about boundaries in general. In general, we need to have internal boundaries and external boundaries, first of all. So internal boundaries are the boundaries we have with ourselves. And this is something I talk about a lot in my book, because I think those get skipped over. I think when we're looking at like Instagram memes, and I am like the number one offender, the memes that people put out, including myself, are about external boundaries. It's like, here's a list of 10 things you could say to your parent if they are violating your boundaries, or here's a list of 5 things that you need to say to your workplace when they're violating your boundaries. Those are external. Those are when our boundary has been violated. So we have to say out loud what we want the other person to do. The majority of the time, though, the first boundary work has to do with whether or not we have boundaries with ourselves. And so if I'm tired, do I have a good enough boundary with myself to get into bed and to go to sleep? If I can't do any more work, do I have a good enough boundary to stop checking my email? Or do I keep flipping the email open on my phone mindlessly? And then now all of a sudden, I think I have to set a boundary with my boss. And that's where those external boundaries start to get triggered. So internal boundaries are being a good parent to ourselves, right? Saying, hey, you don't have any gas left in your tank. You got to stop. You have to eat. You have to go to sleep. Maybe those friends aren't really nice friends to hang out with. Sorry, I'm not going to let you go hang out with them anymore. So being able to say those things to yourself. External boundaries are those boundaries that everybody talks about. And there's proactive and reactive external boundaries. So proactive would be saying something like, hey, I'm really excited to hang out tonight, but just a heads up, I have to leave at 10 p.m. So you are letting the person know ahead of time, so there's not even an issue. Reactive is you didn't say anything in advance, maybe because you didn't think about it or you didn't expect that you needed to. Totally normal. And then something happens and you have to say something, which might be something like, oh, wow. No, I didn't realize that like you were going to want me to work on this project on Saturday. I thought we were going to work on it on Monday. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to do that. So you're having to react in that moment and set a limit. So those are the different types of boundaries we might have to set within categories of like our physical health, our emotional health, our financial health, our relational health. So that's kind of a kind of long and also quick overview. Does that all make sense?
Oh, definitely. Yes. Yeah. I really like the internal boundaries, especially because I think that it's really easy, or it's not easy to set external boundaries, of course, but with ourselves, it's kind of like, oh, well, I guess that can just change. And I don't need it. I think we don't prioritize our needs in ourselves as much. So that's really helpful.
I think so. And I think you can tell me what you think, where that comes from. I would love to hear what your theory is. For me, like a lot of it comes from just from a young age, a lot of us have to disconnect from ourselves to be in relationships. So even in innocent ways, you know, like it's not always like traumatic or anything like that, but just innocent ways. Oh, you know, my mommy loves it when we play outside. And so even though like, I feel like it's too cold to play outside, like I'll play outside because I like to be with my mom. Yeah. Or, my friends, they all love to play X, Y, and Z. And even though I like to just sit in the corner and paint, I'm going to go outside and play tag because that's what they like to do. So to connect, sometimes in traumatizing ways, sometimes in innocuous ways, we like lose ourselves to do that. And then when we are adults, we forget that we have to pay attention to it. And as children, we have grownups paying attention for us, hopefully, ideally. So we have the grownups saying, honey, you know, you have a broken leg. I don't think it's a good idea that you go like outside running around, or you're really tired today. I'm sorry, but you're not going to be able to go to the party. When we're grownups, we have to be able to take over that skill. And a lot of us don't know how to do it. But I would love to hear what you think as well.
Yeah, I really like that a lot. And I think in addition, the pressures that go on in our world to kind of not listen to our internal signals and to push past them. And I think you're right, like we have parents to kind of reinforce those things when we're younger, but when we get older, it's really a lot of responsibility on us to take care of ourselves. And it's hard to adult. So
it's hard to adult. Very, very, very hard. I'm actually writing this down because I want to remember what we were just saying, because I think it's actually pretty profound to think about how we, you know, we disconnect to connect, we disconnect with ourselves to connect with others. And that unless as children, we have an adult kind of bringing us back to ourselves and saying, remember you're hungry, remember you're tired, remember that'll probably give you a boo-boo if you do that again. remember that that person you were dating wasn't so nice to you. Are you sure you want to go out on a date again this weekend? I don't know if I want to let them pick you up in a car because they drive dangerously. If we don't have that, or if we do have it, but we never develop it ourselves, like it's going to be pretty hard to figure out how to navigate that when we're off on our own. I think that's pretty huge.
Yeah. And we don't really learn to take over that role of checking in on ourselves. It really shifts very suddenly. Yeah. And so when we don't have either a parent checking in or even friends can feel invasive, it is hard to take over that role.
It's really hard to take over that role. And there's not this moment in life, I don't think, for most of us. And it's interesting to think historically, there was coming of age moments where there would be more clear celebrations into adulthood. And that might trigger this idea of, oh, I'm going to have to start taking over X, Y, and Z. It would be a little more clear cut. And I think if you look across cultures, there used to be a lot of those types of celebrations. And now I feel like there isn't really anything like that. Maybe you go away to school or whatever it is, but there's not this big thing where it's like, now I'm handing you the keys to your life. And just a heads up, these are some things that you're going to have to start thinking about and things that I'm not going to be able to, even if I wish I could, I'm not going to be able to do them for you anymore.
Definitely. And there's not really a guide to do that as well, which is, I think, interesting. And we don't really learn life skills as much in universities these days. And so definitely all those things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't think we don't learn life skills at all in, you know, elementary. And I think some are starting to try to put that in there, but it has, because of the need to perform and test and do all of those things, I think that something that schools used to offer, now we're like, I love where our conversation's going. I think something schools used to offer was socialization and helping to guide people on how to socialize and how to live. Even if you think about like home economics classes, which definitely in some ways, probably somewhat problematic because the boys would be separated into like building things and the girls would be separated into sewing. But there was definitely a focus on life being about more than learning math. Life was also about learning how to take care of a home or build things or play on the playground and make friends. And I think teachers are under so much pressure now to test that school is just about academics.
100%. And it's very stressful for students. There's a lot of pressure on them with getting the right grades from very young ages now. I remember I saw a college day for kindergartners and I was like, oh my goodness, I wasn't thinking about that in kindergarten.
No way. We were going like maybe apple picking or something.
Exactly.
Johnny Appleseed Day was like the biggest day.
I still love orchards so much.
I do too. Yeah. I was working. So my first job out of grad school was in an elementary school and I was working with kids. And I remember thinking, geez, school sucks now. Like it was so fun when I was little, and not that I didn't have challenges. There was still some bullying. There was still like stress and I hated taking tests, but I don't remember the focus being so much on achievement, like so much on like, let's practice the test. We're taking another test this whole week. They have whole weeks based on testing now where the entire week would be testing. And so the entire week before that would be prepping for the tests. We didn't have that. We had like, hey, by the way, kids, next week, you're going to have like a times table test. And we would take it on Monday, you know, for 30 minutes. And then we would go back to like business again. And so it's, yeah, it's a lot. And so a lot gets missed because of that.
For sure. I think we are underestimating how valuable those interactions are outside of just learning and absorbing information. Because I also think it's interesting how as kids, we get weekends and we get afternoons to play with other people. But as adults, it's expected that you go home and work after work, and you continue to work on weekends, and it just misses out on some really helpful things for identifying your own needs and for being able to have enough energy to be there for ourselves and others.
I love that. Yeah, just thinking like kids, they get to look forward to summer being off, and they get to look forward to coming home and playing and creating and all of that. And when we grow up, you know, quote, grow up, we start to change that cadence for ourselves, or we're forced to change it. And then we forget about the stuff that used to like light us up, I think.
Yeah. And that keeps us going, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So switching gears a little bit, everyone wants to know the secret to long-lasting happy relationships. Is there just one?
I don't think so. I think it's so, so, so nuanced. And if there was a secret, I think we would all share it with each other. I would hope it wouldn't be a resource that any of us would hoard. Because then I think we would all say, oh, great, I'm just gonna utilize this method and all of my relationships will be long lasting. I think the secret, there's a few secrets to fulfilling relationships. And so maybe not about how long they last, but about how good they feel. And I think part of that is being able to really pay attention to, you know, how are we taking responsibility for ourselves within this relationship? Am I taking too much responsibility? Am I taking too little responsibility for this relationship? And so a huge piece of building a fulfilling relationship is trying to like straddle that and saying, I'm going to be in the middle. I'm going to take just enough responsibility for the relationship and for making sure the other person feels loved and all of that. And I'm also going to take a ton of responsibility for myself, making sure that I'm taking care of myself, that I'm setting boundaries, that I am maintaining a self-identity and all of those important things. And I'm going to expect that the other person is responsible to me and also responsible to themselves. One of the things I see happen a lot, which I don't know if you see this as well, but I feel like a lot of relationship advice is about one or the other. It's either like, oh, this other person is such a terrible person, I'm going to diagnose them with 8 million disorders that I have no business diagnosing them with. And then because of that, I'm going to overfunction in some sort of way. I'm either going to take a ton of responsibility for changing them and none for saying, well, if I think they're such an asshole, maybe I should break up with them. Or I'm going to think that they should take all the responsibility for how crappy our relationship is. And I'm going to put my hands up and I'm not going to like invest anymore. So I see that, or I see on the other end where it's like, you know, just be in it. And like, your partner is your partner and totally accept them and this and this and that. And like, so it's either this like total self-care, everybody else sucks, or like be totally in it and always has to be like that. And you should put yourself fully in there. And I feel like that imbalance distorts things so much and keeps people so stuck.
100%. And I like what you said, about how advice is usually very like one-sided. And I think it's because it gets people's attention and it's like one small thing you can do or one thing you can kind of stick to without thinking about, oh, but in this situation, it kind of changes a little bit, or, you know, there's an in-between that nobody really likes to be inside of.
Well, and it's hard. And I can say as someone that, you know, shares information, it's hard to remind people there's nuance, because there is information you want to share. Like, let's say the qualities of an abusive partner. You don't want to have a post that says, you know, overzealous jealousy is the sign of an abusive partner. And it could also be a sign of da 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 da, because it makes it then really hard, I think, for people to like hold on to a concept and integrate it. So there's something to be said, I think, about providing something as a concept by itself without watering it down. And I think that then individual responsibility is to be able to take that concept in and then negotiate that within yourself. And I think that's the really hard thing. And I started to notice myself online almost feeling like I have to negotiate that for people. Like I have to be like, here's all the information. And here's a whole bunch of caveats so that you can negotiate this with inside of yourself and you can decide whether or not this applies to you. And I think that's important for me to do. And sometimes I'm like, where is this headed? Like, are we able to see something and have enough relational awareness, have enough self-awareness to say, yes, and how does this apply to me? And what can I do about it? What can I do so that I feel empowered with it instead of feeling disempowered where it's, oh, my partner's absolutely a psychopathic narcissist, but, oh, wow, my partner does these things. They hurt me. I see these. They suck. Maybe what that means for me is I need to step away. I need to break up with them. I need to talk to a therapist. I need to set boundaries. I need to do whatever. But I see that loss of self-negotiation that happens with information that's provided. And I think that that's where the disconnect is. It's like, there's all this mental health information out there, but then because there's not a therapist with the person in the room, there's not the ability for a mirror to like help them integrate it and to say, oh yeah, that does make sense. And this is how it connects to you. And this is what you could do about it. That was kind of like a tangent, but I think it's like an interesting thing to think about. And I think it goes back to your first question, which is what's important in a relationship. And what's important in a relationship is looking at what's happening and then being able to integrate what that means for you and then figure out what you're going to do, because you can't make the other person do anything.
Yes. It reminds me of that sense of responsibility that's personal that we talked about a little before, in terms of, you know, there's some responsibility on people who are absorbing this information to ask for help, to figure out how it applies to their life, to do, to kind of engage with it in a way that's not just accept exactly how you first experienced that.
Yeah.
And then there's some responsibility on the person to, you know, mention like a little bit of nuance or a little bit of caveat. So it's not just like, this is how it goes all the time. But I think it's that balance between, you know,
totally
answer every comment. And yeah.
And one thing you said was like those really, snappy posts that are like, your partner is a, I'm going to use narcissist because those are just so popular. If they, and then it's like a list, but people share those because they get a ton of attention. And I think, like you said, it's really important that the person creating that is thinking about where could this go wrong? And it's not their responsibility to prevent all the areas that it could go wrong in every single person's life and to create every nuance, but to offer a perspective of maybe these are some signs. This might be X, Y, and Z. You know, reading the information above might bring up questions like X, Y, and Z, and this is how you could explore it further. When people don't do that at all, it concerns me because I think it becomes more about the likes than about actually getting people to figure out how to integrate it. And I'm not saying anybody is perfect. I've posted things like that unknowingly, just like, oh, this sounds good and it's snappy and da 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 da. And then people will comment and I'm like, you're right. You are right. Let me fix my caption a little bit to add in a little bit more here. And that goes back to relational awareness. You know, exactly what we're talking about on the internet is when I'm talking about in intimate partnerships. I can't take too much responsibility for you, but I still need to take responsibility for the fact that I could impact you. I still need to have responsibility for whether or not what I'm sharing is accurate as it could be, is fair, is nuanced enough. But I can't be codependent and like soften it all so much that it like never brings anything up. And the other person receiving it they have to be responsible for like paying attention if it fits for them, exploring it, muting it if it's not good. And they can't be so responsible for the other person that if the other person's like super harmful, like they don't need to be like, oh, well, that isn't really helpful to me, but I still have to like internalize it, or I still have to do it, or whatever. So it comes back to that ability to have relational awareness again.
And that's a really helpful skill to acquire in relationships online, in person, because I think there's the tendency to either overdo it and self-deprecate and kind of be like, well, it's all my fault and I think this way, or completely the other side, like it's completely their fault. And yeah. I did nothing wrong. And, you know, I think it's interesting, like in therapy too, sometimes it's validating to hear like, oh, that wasn't your fault. And it's hard to say to someone that it's not your fault. And also,
yeah,
there's like maybe some responsibility in that relationship. And that doesn't invalidate that it's not your fault. It just means that there's an in-between fault and responsibility.
Well, and in my own therapy, the most powerful moments have been when my therapist has actually not validated me. has definitely empathized with me and said, oh, that sounds hard, or I could see why you see it that way. So empathized, understood, seen how it makes sense, but not said, you're right. And instead said something like, you know, though I'm hearing there's like this pattern, you know, my therapist said, like, it sounds very similar to like when X, Y, and Z happened. And it sounds like when that kind of thing happens, you can tend to get pretty snappy with people or something. What's that about? And so sometimes in being pushed with empathy and care and gentleness, that's where our biggest aha moments can lie, if we're willing to accept it though.
Exactly. I think that confrontational tool is a therapist is tricky because, you know, you want to get it across that message and you want to challenge your clients to grow, while also being supportive and empathetic. And that's a really good way of putting it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love that you talked about that confrontational skill. It's an important one.
All right. Let's see. What is it like working with more than one person in therapy?
It's really fun for me. I'm not sure that everybody would say that. I know we all have different experiences. Some people say it's exhausting or overwhelming. For me, it's much more dynamic and it gives me a lot more information. So if I'm only working with one person, it's all self-report. Mm-hmm. And I also don't see like the enactments as much. So I might see them eventually with the engagement between me and the person, you know, at some point, because there's actually always more than one person in the room, in the therapy room. Mm-hmm. So all therapy is systems therapy, all of it. All of it is relationship therapy, because you have to continually look at how is your client engaging with you and how are you engaging with them? Because what's happening there is probably similar to what's happening in the outside world. And if it's different, you want to know why. So if your client comes in and they're like totally engaging and sweet and easy to work with, but they tell you that everyone around them says that they're hard to work with and da 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 da, being able to say, well, there's two people in this room and I think you're engaging and easy to work with. What's happening somewhere else? Why are we having a better experience? So all therapy is in a weird way, kind of like couples therapy. You're constantly having to look at it. But when there's three people or more in the room, that to me is so dynamic. And it's really cool to see, because somebody might've reported to you X, Y, and Z is happening. And then you watch it in the room and you're like, oh, that's why it's happening. It's because this person, when they do this thing, it brings this up in you, or it's actually not happening that way. Can I give you another perspective on how it's happening? And the session moves much more quickly because you're having them talk, you're having them do a lot of the work, you're bringing them together, you're allowing them to share each other's reflections of each other. So yeah, I love it. It's fun.
That's awesome. I think it's, it sounds like as well, when you have multiple people in those interactions, you can kind of see what they're really like, as opposed to kind of being like an investigator and figuring out what that relationship in the here and now is reflecting about other people's.
Well, we all have friends where we're like, I know they're in therapy, but what do they say to their therapist about this issue? I don't know if you have any, like everyone, I think they will hear, oh, you know, they're really struggling. Like, let's imagine that we have a friend who's just gone through a breakup and they're really struggling. And they come to you and you know they're going to a therapist and they're like repeating the information again and again, and you see them doing things that aren't good for themselves. And you're like, I know they're seeing a therapist, but I wish I could talk to the therapist, because I don't really know if the therapist understands that this is what's happening. Like, does the therapist know that they are texting their ex like all day long? Like, do they know that part, and how are they helping them with it? When we have more than one person in the room as a therapist, it's so great because we hear the pieces of the story that people are either too shy to share, too embarrassed to share, or they don't recognize as important to share. And I think it really helps to get a full picture.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And what is your kind of favorite theoretical orientation to view kind of family systems through?
That's such a great question. So I'm definitely eclectic and I like to pull based off of like who I'm meeting with. I'm a certified Gottman therapist. So I definitely use that with couples, but I also see it a lot in families. Like if I see hypercriticism or defensiveness or any of that. So I use a lot of Gottman. I like to use Gottman as well because it's dyadic, which means that I'm supposed to pull myself out of their conversations. You know, they're not supposed to talk to me. I'm supposed to say, hey, stop, don't talk to me, share that with them. Or the way you're sharing that is not helpful. Try it this way. All right, do it again. So I love that. I use a lot of relational life therapy. So helping people to notice when they're being grandiose, helping people to notice when they're being submissive, and helping them to get into an equal playing field. I'm guided a lot by feminist theory. So really recognizing like power dynamics and being able to openly address them. I think that, I don't know about your coursework, but I remember that theory was kind of like brushed over. It's like, okay, here's three paragraphs on feminist theory and da, 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 da. But to me, it's been one of the most important theories in couples therapy, and where I'm able to get my power in the session to help other people have their power, to be able to say, hey, you know, like what's the way you're talking right now is this, if you're like above this person, you're not taking their influence. And like, we really want you to both be on an equal playing field here. And that's not just for women, it's for anyone in the therapy room. So that has been really influential. And then narrative therapy is huge. Like, what's the story that they tell themselves about their relationships, their mental health, the world, all of that. I think the stories that we create have such a big impact on who we are.
I like that a lot. And I really like the consideration of systems of oppression for feminist theory. I think it's important that everyone, I think all therapists should adopt a little bit of feminist therapy.
I agree. Yeah. And like a lot of therapy, and I don't know, have you done any trainings on RLT yet?
I haven't.
I really like it for the same reason I like feminist theory, is that they call a spade a spade. So if someone is being sexist, you say the word. If someone's being racist, you say the word. If someone's being abusive, you say the word. And I think as therapists, I was reading an article the other day about like the fact that I think this is actually a more recent time thing. Therapists have gotten like way too soft, and we try to like dance around everything. Like, so I'm wondering what's coming up for you as you're calling that person a stupid bitch. You think that like it could be experienced as sexist or wondering doing? Like, what's happening when you're treating your employee like that? Like, is it just wondering, like, what comes through? And we dance around it so much. And I like that. I think that feminist theory does this really well. I think that Terry Real does this really well. I definitely recommend you watch some videos of Terry Real doing this, where he can still join. And I don't think we see a lot of these examples. He can join so well with people and in the same moment say, this is going to be hard to hear, but you are very abusive. You're an abuser of your wife. What's that like for you to hear that? And the person doesn't punch his lights out. They don't run out of the therapy room, but they can change. They can change character traits that are unhealthy for themselves, for the relationship, for the world. And so when I'm supervising people, they're often shocked at what I ask them to say. Like, I will tell them, I think you should say that that is X, Y, and Z. And I think you should identify that it has to do with power. It has to do with control. And then of course you go deeper and you talk about maybe the shame that's created that, maybe trauma that's created that, wherever that comes from, we have to name it. A lot of my supervisees will be like, God, aren't they going to hate me? And it's like, no, because you're going to join and you're going to love them and you're going to have, you know, positive regard, but you have to name it. I think that's so important.
I love that. I like that direct approach. And I think it's interesting because therapists are always saying, don't impose your values. And at the same time, you know, you're a human being interacting with another person. You're going to be affected by what they say. And there's some social responsibility in terms of like not encouraging people to be hateful or to be sexist or things like that. And I think that's misconception and about it.
Yes. And I think there's like a lot of these things that are true in theory. So like, don't impose your values. I think that came out of like, if your client comes in and says that they want to spend money on a Maserati, like it's not really your job to say, I don't really like to spend money on Maseratis. I don't think you should. But as clinicians, we have a skill set and we have an understanding of health, of relational health and mental health. And to say that isms don't impact those things is to then say that you're taking away some of your clinical knowledge. If someone is being hateful, that should be something that you're using as a conceptualization in your case. And to say, well, I ignore that because it's a word I don't like to use and I'm afraid they're going to feel offended, is the same as if you said, my client has had a lot of mania recently and they spent $8 million this weekend and they had sex with 800 people and then they came in and they're really upset, but I don't want to put my values on them. And so I'm actually not going to explore if they're struggling with their mental health. I'm just going to let them, my client came in and they cut this weekend. I don't want to put my values on them because that might offend them. They want to cut. That's their cutter. We would not do that with any other clinical information that we have. We would say, hey, how do you feel about the money you spent this weekend? Does that feel in line with who you are? Is that helping you feel good about your life? Is that, you know, ooh, cutting, that feels scary. What's going on? You know, that could be a sign of X, Y, and Z. What should we do to help that? But for some reason, and part of me thinks that this is like almost more recent because people have gotten afraid to say anything about anything. For some reason, therapists are saying that that doesn't have to do with, not all therapists, but some are saying that doesn't have to do with their clinical knowledge, but it does, because you know that if someone is being controlling, it's a sign of abuse. So if they're being controlling over another gender, race, anybody, then why are you not using your clinical framework to talk about that? Those are just my two cents.
Yeah, I really like that. And I think it's not recognized or taught as much. But it's important. And obviously there's so much training that happens outside of grad school. So
yeah. And it's scary to talk about. Mm-hmm. It's scary for people.
Yeah. Naming is such a powerful thing.
Yeah. And therapists don't want to hurt people. And so naming certain things can feel hurtful. And I think it's like, sometimes we use the excuse, I don't want to push my values on them. But I often ask my supervisees, but really what's under that? Is it truly like, can you explore that a little bit? Because is it that you worry that if you push your values, that like, is you overstepping, or are you afraid it's going to hurt their feelings? And, or are you afraid that they're going to be mad at you? And if those two feelings are coming up, that almost always means you need to say it. Almost always. If it's like, oh no, it wouldn't hurt their feelings if I tell them not to buy a Maserati. Yeah. Then don't say anything about it, 'cause it's not your business. But like, if it would hurt, if you're afraid it's going to hurt their feelings, that they're going to think differently of you, they're going to think you're an ass, it probably means you need to say it. And that's hard. And you have to consult, how do you say it in a way that can be received? But, it's scary being a therapist and like actually doing treatment. Mm-hmm. It's hard.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting too, because in helping professions, you're wanting to create changes that the patient or the client really likes. Like in medicine, you're always wanting them to feel better. And I think therapy is a little different because you don't always feel better in the moment, but you're growing, and that's important.
Yeah, it's so true. And I think I also think we feel like if we don't make them feel better, they're not going to come back the next session, and then we'll lose them. And that's really hard. But if you think about it, like even our doctors have to make us feel crappy sometimes before they make us feel better, right? Like if you have to get a hip surgery, it is not going to feel good. And if the doctor said, well, I don't want to hurt you, so I'm just not going to tell you that you need a hip surgery, you would have to live with a bad hip. So the doctor has to be brave enough to say, I'm sorry, I know this is going to be hard to hear, but you're going to have to do X, Y, and Z. But when they can do that, then they can give you what you need. And I think as therapists, we have to do the same thing.
Definitely. I like that a lot. Wow, this is such a good conversation. I'm like trying to pick which questions I want to pick out. but I guess one of the last bigger questions, are relationships worth it if I always end up getting hurt? And how to cultivate safer feelings in relationships?
Yeah. So if somebody was asking me that, like in the therapy room, I'd have a couple questions. Like the first is about the all or nothing thinking I hear in there. Are relationships worth it if I always get hurt? And I would be really curious about that word. So I'd probably say something like, always, you know, tell me a little bit about always. And there would probably be some really big stories, you know, really big moments. Well, I remember being hurt by my parents. And then there was this really important friendship. They hurt me. And my partner just broke up with me. And my kids are mad at me right now, or something like that. And the first thing I would try to work with is, can we remove always? And can we kind of look at the entire picture here? Like, let's not only look at other relationships that exist that haven't been hurtful and talk about those and explore how they've influenced you, but let's also look at these relationships that you've had that have had a result at the end that hurt, but what were the moments like in the in-between? And some of the stories might be the whole thing was hurtful, was an abusive relationship, a neglectful relationship, or it might be, oh my God, there was so much fun at the beginning and it was lovely. And, you know, our lives went in a different direction and then we moved apart and there was an affair and that really hurt, but there was a lot of beauty too. And so the first thing I would want to explore is always, because when we use always, we get ourselves into distortions that keep us stuck. The second thing I would want to explore is, well, what is the point of relationships for them? I can't tell them what's the point, you know? I could tell you that research shows that our lives are happier when we have them, that daily life it's easier to function in daily life when we have them, when we can call, you know, a friend or a parent or whoever and say, I broke my leg, can you bring me milk? Like, these are functional things that we need. And I don't know what you value about them. So I would really want to hear what's the point to you. And there's lots of answers. You know, I want a family. I don't want to feel alone. I love building things with people. I like to do fun activities. I don't want to travel by myself, you know, all of those things. And so I wouldn't have a direct answer of what's the point, but I would want to explore with them what has been the point, what's been good, what's been hard. And then also like, why for them? You know, what do they get out of relationships? What do they give in their relationships as well?
I think that's where the values come in that are differing and okay. In that, like, the therapist's reasons for relationships might be very different than the client's, and figuring out what needs they need to be filled through different areas.
That is such a smart way to like bring back what we were just talking about. This is a great moment where like our values still need to come into it. You know, we might say, oh God, I just value so much like being married. Like for me, I love being married. I love being a mom. Like it's my favorite. And I might have a client who says, I don't want to be married. Don't want to have kids. Like I'm struggling with the point of relationships because if I don't want to get married or have kids, what's the point? And if I said, well, you should want to have kids and have a marriage. Like, what are you talking about? That would be the wrong move. For my values coming in, that's where you want to be more like, yeah, so what's the point for you? Like, what do you like with your friends? What's good about dating? What value does it bring to your life?
Definitely. A fun question. What are your favorite foods?
Oh, I love this question because I love food. Okay. I'm a very food motivated person. Okay. So many foods. I love anything with curry in it. So I am a big, big fan of food with tons of curry. I love to make this lemongrass chicken that is delicious. If you want the recipe, I can send it to you. It takes like 5 minutes to make, and it's the most, I mean, like you have to cook it for a little longer, but like throwing everything in takes like 5 minutes. It is so good. And because of that, my son loves curry too, which is really fun. So we're like always eating like these yummy, spicy, rich foods. I love sushi, which is very basic of me, I feel like. And I love, love, love spaghetti. Like I could eat spaghetti every single day of my life and never get tired of it. So you can tell I like carbs, I think is what just came out of that question. I'm like, loving curried rice dishes, rice with sushi.
I love it.
Yeah, those are my favorite. What are your favorite foods?
Ooh, I think I really like grilled cheese.
Ooh, I love grilled cheese. It's so good.
It is. It makes me so happy. And I really like French fries. I could eat them all the time. And
me too. How did I miss McDonald's French fries?
Oh my gosh, they're so perfect.
I like literally whenever I'm driving in the car, I have like an immediate like Pavlov's dog moment where I'm just like, all I want is French fries right now.
I relate to that so much. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
I love it. That. You and I need to have a French fry, grilled cheese, spaghetti, curry, sushi party.
Yes. All the things.
All the things.
Oh my goodness. Well, my last question that I ask everybody, how are you becoming?
Oh, that is such a sweet question. So how am I becoming? Is that kind of like looking for growth? Like what is something I'm trying to grow with? Or how do people usually answer it?
Yeah. And some people say like, I'm working on like spending time with family or self-care, or I'm becoming in that, like, I don't have to be always growing, something like that.
I love that question. That is such a beautiful question. Okay. So I study relationships, but I suck in them sometimes. And one of the things that I've been really trying to work on is that when I'm frustrated, not with other people, but with my husband, I can be critical. I like will almost never be critical of others, but with him, I'm like, you always do that. why do you always like leave that around? Why don't you ever think of me? Da, 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 da. And I get like this like other person like comes into my body and I'm just like nasty. And so something that I am working on and that I've been becoming is someone who can recognize that I'm feeling stress in my body and know to shut up and like just not to say anything until the stress passes, because that's almost always when I'm critical. And it's been something I've been working on for like a year, and it's been really cool because I've noticed a change. Like I'm actually having internal dialogue with myself where I'm like, you're about to say something super bitchy. Go take a shower and think about it. So I'm trying to become a calmer person. That's what I'm becoming. Like a person that doesn't use, and I don't want to have, what is it called? Not a snake tongue. What is it called when you're very like serpent? Cutting? What'd you say?
I feel like people call it like a serpent's tongue.
Yeah. I don't want to have like a serpent's tongue. I don't want to be cutting when I'm stressed. So I'm becoming a person that does not do that.
I love that. I feel like it's so helpful too, to like pause and think about how is this going to impact the relationship? And you can always come back to it if you decide that that's a great comment to make.
Yeah. And like most of the time I'm wanting to talk about something valid, mm-hmm. and I do not need to be so nasty.
Oh my goodness. Both yeah. and.
This both and. Both and.
Well, thank you so much. It's been so wonderful talking to you.
It's been so nice talking to you too. This was such a fun conversation.
Yes, I'm so excited.
Thank you. Yeah.